Hey, Lee, look what I found on the hill.
My guess is it's an animal bone, and there just happened to be...
Some other animal shot it.
Yeah. Hi, Mom. I was thinking about coming down.
I just need a break.
I'll do the taxes.
No, but see,
I'll
and then do you see what happens?
I'm sorry.
Why isn't Daddy?
Sometimes mommies want daddies to pitch in, and if you don't, mommy comes after you and goes, rawr. So daddy is at home doing his homework.
This is very strange.
We would start constructing this.
Get ready. We are going to have a fun Saturday night.
I found this, and then I found that, man.
Well, let's keep digging.
We're going to just sort of hang here.
Hey everybody, Adam Shartoff here, host of Filmwax Radio. This is episode number 310 of the podcast. You know, I am struggling here because I don't have any time. I've been working. I don't have the free time I had, not free time, but I had more time anyway to get the shows up in a very, very, you know, expeditious manner. And I just don't really have the same amount of time at the moment. So I'm just letting you know, I apologize to everybody. Normally, I would have had this episode, number 310, out at least yesterday, if not the day before. And as you know, I posted the Jerry Schatzberg episode, and then I fell behind because I had to get that up, and I meant to say by Thursday, or at least Friday morning, to get up this show, because I'm talking about two films that actually opened up, I guess, yesterday. It's Saturday right now, the 22nd of August, when I'm posting this and recording this. Although in the wee hours. And I would have had this up Friday because two of the films that we're going to be talking about today opened Friday, theatrically. Anyway, the first is, well, it's a segment with the filmmaker John McGarry, who has a new film called The Mend, which stars the actor Josh Lucas, Mickey Sumner. And she's on the show with the director John McGarry and one of the film producers, Minna Joseph. They're going to be joining us, and we recorded this segment in a restaurant. That's what happened. We tried to find the quietest spot, and sometimes in New York City, you just can't find the quiet spot. The summertime and the place is buzzing, man. If you're listening to this place and you have some idea that New York City is just this bastion of excitement and energy and that people are just going, well, you're right. That's exactly what New York City is like. And so when I was trying to find a quiet spot to do this podcast episode, because we decided to meet in a place, we needed to meet somewhere in the middle of town, we found a nice restaurant. This segment was recorded at the L&W Oyster Company, which is located at 254 Fifth Avenue in New York. It's the Flatiron District, right on Fifth Avenue, between 28th and 29th Streets. Thank you to the lovely team and the staff there, the waiters, the manager. Great people for allowing us to conduct our podcast there. It wasn't like they needed to be all interrupted like that, but they were very, very accommodating. So thanks again. Go visit that for some great food, great wine, great drinks, great grub. Again, the name of the place, L&W Oyster Company. Thank you. So we met with Mickey Sumner and the director, John McGarry. Now, Mickey Sumner, you know, she was in Frances Ha. That's when she came on my radar. And then I found out, oh, she's the daughter of Sting and Trudy Styler. Makes sense, right? His name is Gordon Sumner. But I didn't know that this woman existed until I saw Frances Ha a couple of years ago. And now she's in this movie called The Mend. And a friend of mine named Michael Prawl is one of the producers. He brought this film to my attention. It premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival in 2014. It went on to screen at BAM Cinema Fest, the Dallas International Film Festival, and on and on and on. Let's see, what do we say here about the film? The synopsis for the movie, which, by the way, is quote-unquote presented by David Gordon Green. For anyone who's ever loathed and loved a sibling in equal measure, The Mend is the wonderfully strange and acidic debut comedy from writer-director John McGarry, shot through with the wicked humor and anarchy of Bruce Robinson's With Nail and I and Mike Lee's Naked. The Mend follows a mismatched yin-yang pair of New York City brothers, Loose Cannon Matt, played by the actor Josh Lucas, and Put Upon Alan, played by Stephen Plunkett, as they stagger dimly towards understanding of love, women, masculinity, what it truly means to be a brother. Now, by the way. Neither Josh Lucas nor Steve Plunkett are on this podcast. But we do have, again, Miss Mickey Sumner. We have John McGarry. And we have one of the producers of the film, Minna Joseph. They'll be joining me in just a few minutes. And then, if that weren't enough, we have another segment with Joe Swamber coming back for his 15th appearance on Film Wax Radio. That's a complete and utter lie. I think it's his third or fourth. I can't remember. I'm not going to go back and bother to look because really, what does it matter? But he's been on with just about every film he's directed in the last few years, which says a lot because in a year, you know, he can produce like three or four films if he wants to. But he slowed down a little. He had, you know, Drinking Buddies out, and then he did Happy Christmas, and now he's back with a new film. It's called Digging for Fire, and it co-stars let me take a step back. It's a great ensemble film. And one of the actors in it, who is the lead actor, is Jake Johnson. Other actors in it, oh my goodness, there's just tons and tons of indie actors. Let's see. Well, Kent Osborne has a tiny role, and he's been on the show. But who else? Well, Sam Rockwell is in it. Jenny Slate has a very small role in it. Rosemary DeWitt, Orlando Bloom, Brie Larson, who has, by the way, been on this podcast. Anna Kendrick and Mike Birbiglia. And it's co-produced by Jake Johnson, Joe Swamberg, and Alicia Vancouvering, who also, Alicia has been on the show. So this makes sense that I would want to talk to everybody. The film had its world premiere at Sundance, you know, just this year. And it's being distributed by The Orchard and Sony Pictures Worldwide, acquired the international rights. What is it about? Well, it's a dramedy. And it's co-written by Swanberg and Jake Johnson. You'll hear about that collaboration. Jake Johnson plays a guy. He's husband to Rosemary DeWitt. They have a toddler who's played by Joe Swanberg's son, Jude. And they are house-sitting in a ritzy part of L.A. But Alicia goes in and takes the kid, and they visit the grandparents while Tim, played by again by Jake Johnson's having a party and a great time. He's avoiding doing the work he's supposed to do, which is their taxes, and has a wild party. And meanwhile, he's in the backyard in the garden, and he discovers a bones, and he discovers a rusty gun and all this stuff, and he becomes sort of obsessed with that. And it's a very, very dark and yet funny film. Go figure. It's a very interesting film. It's an ensemble, and there's a lot of great actors. I mentioned most of them. So we'll talk to those guys in just a little while. But first, we're going to talk to in the first segment with Mickey Sumner and Minna Joseph and director John McGarry. Now, I just want to tell you one thing. In the Swanberg thing, and you'll hear it in a little while at the end, I mentioned to him that the next day I'm going to be talking to the legendary film producer, Roger Corman. I don't know if I mentioned this on the show, but now I'm sort of going to make some news here, I guess, a little bit. We may be having him on the show. I don't know, because as I record this at almost 2 in the morning on Saturday, the 22nd of August, I'm supposed to call him tomorrow morning. I talked to him today, which was incredible, but I'm going to talk to him again tomorrow. And but I decided just to go to the hotel and call him from like the lobby. It's going to be it's a little tacky, but I don't want to miss the opportunity. So I'm bringing all my equipment. I'm going down there. We're going to see if I can meet with Roger Corman tomorrow. So that's what's, I don't know. On this episode, we don't know the answer. So you're just going to have to wait a little longer to see if I get on the Roger Corman. Roger freaking Corman. Okay, let's go into my first segment here with regarding the movie The Mend with John McGarry, Minna Joseph, and the lovely Mickey Sumner.
I'm getting sick. I've got phlegm. Something funny over there.
Just you being useful. It's like a parody of usefulness.
Even happy things just roll off you.
They do, Ellen,
no, you don't.
I would like to look in your eyes and see that you're feeling
you're
something.
You're being ridiculous.
10 minutes of performance. Lie to
what
me.
What are you doing?
Yeah. Man's on the couch.
You're a marginal thief.
Glad you came.
I've been here.
I just figured you were in some anger loop for 3 months, just screaming at the wall.
This place is cozy.
So I'll just start it. Start off. Does it appear like this is my first time doing this? I'm feeling a little bit like it might be.
I feel like that's your angle.
There's no way to do this.
Oh, it's that a little. Right, and then it turns out he's shrewder than he appears. That's what I always hope is the takeaway. You know, He looks a little simple, but he's...
No.
All right, so, well, we're talking about The Mend, which is, just to get it out of the way, is opening in New York on August 21st?
That's right. Exactly 1 month from today.
1 month from today. Now they know when we're recording. Oh, I guess it doesn't matter.
John, should I give our location?
John, we're going to, because they were so kind to let us sit here. We're L&W Oyster Company. I can vouch. These are the best damn oysters.
Oh, they're delicious.
I can hawk a sponsor. They're not a sponsor technically, but
so smell very good.
If you're downtown, what would you say?
Jesus Christ, we're close
to Koreatown.
We're in Flatiron.
We are just blocks from that.
Nondescript part of town.
We're in Flatiron, and we're in Flatiron at L&W Oyster Company. So talking to the mic, Mickey.
Plastic beads.
Oh, those types of things.
Bracelets.
I do, right. Buttons and all sorts of accessories. What do you call those? Accessories.
Bedazzles? Yeah.
Yeah. And you can sew them into embroider? Mm-hmm. Is that this term?
Yep. Okay. I love that.
Are you into crafts?
I love crafts.
Do you?
Yeah. Arts and crafts.
That's the full title. That's right. It's a marriage made in heaven. All right. Let me introduce everybody. First is the DJ. Blasting the... Didn't it get louder again?
It's the Led Zeppelin.
It's the headphones. Well, they're playing classics.
It's a little loud.
Okay, so we're sitting here with John McGarry.
Thank you.
Actress Mickey Sumner, welcome.
Hello.
Lovely to meet you. And producer Minna Joseph. So, as I started to say, The Mend is going to be playing in New York City starting August the 21st. Los Angeles the following week, or is it the same day?
The 28th. 1 week after the Sundance on Sunset.
Okay.
The Sundance Cinemas on Sunset.
Oh, right. Very good.
Boulevard.
And then finally on demand, but...
But we don't know the exact days.
Yeah, it's good to keep that vague anyway.
Just go to the movies.
Go to the movies.
Eat some popcorn.
Yeah. Thank you. Mickey, I also want to mention, too, at some point, the end of the tour, another movie you're in, is opening... It'll be actually out in New York City when we play this because it's opening.
I think the end of this month.
Okay.
End of July.
All right. So it's probably playing near you because I'm sure it's going to be playing for weeks and weeks.
Yeah.
Right? That's a
good
one.
I hope so.
Yeah. You and the daughter of a famous person are in it, a fine actress too, who's going to, by the way, Mamie Gummer, right?
Mamie Gummer.
She is going to also blow up, I think, because she's about to do a movie with her mother that's going to be big, huge. What?
No, that was Grace Gummer.
I get my gummers.
Get your gummers, right.
All right, well, if you... Like you
the words
you,
to
you,
live by.
What movie was that? What movie?
Frances Ha. There's another gummer in Frances Ha. And
how many
I confused the great Grace with Mamie,
which
is a very common confusion.
Like your last name.
Yeah. Because they share the same name and they both are related to Meryl Streep.
Yeah. What was Grace Gummer? What was her role in that? In Frances Ha, do you remember?
She played the dancer. I've forgotten her name in it.
Was that the first roommate? Is that why my friend? No. Like during in the middle or something. There's scenes where, yeah, it's been a while. I was going to rewatch it. I was going to rewatch it actually, but I just didn't have the time to see it again. You know, but I did rewatch The Mend, which is much more important. Because
much more important.
I saw it a long time ago, around the time it premiered at South by Southwest.
Yeah, did you see it there?
No, but I saw it right after. And in the movie, aside from Mickey, you have Josh Lucas is in it.
Josh Lucas,
Steve,
and Stephen Plunkett play brothers.
Yeah,
that's kind of the central relationship for the whole thing. And then Mickey Sumner and Lucy Owen play the beleaguered. Women.
Yeah.
A couple beleaguered women. And Austin Pendleton's in it.
Right,
and a very talented young man named Corey Nichols, who is now 13 or 14.
Oh, right. The son of
Lucy Owen.
Lucy Owen. Okay,
yeah.
Very good. Yeah, he's a very good actor.
I mean,
I'm always shocked, you know, because...
As are we when they come in finally and... When you do the audition with, you know, so many kids, and you see, you know, obviously when they're kids, there's a really wide range of aptitude.
Yes.
And there's also some kind of psychotic children and psychotic parents.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And then...
I can imagine. No, it's true, because, you know, there's worse than the kids that
are not good actors are the ones that are like performer kids, you know? That
yeah.
Are so big.
And you get a fair amount of those who are basically trained to...
Knock them out, exactly, to wow the back row.
Yeah. Right. I just started thinking it'd be really funny if adult actors also came with their parents to auditions. It'd be good. Bring your mom or dad.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's great, and that's the story. There's a lot of other Austin Pendleton's also in it. And he's like an amazing New York. And Rebecca Henderson, Louisa Krauss.
Mickey, you're playing... What's the name of your character?
I'm called Farrah.
Farrah, that's right, Farrah. And you are Steve Plunkett?
Steven Plunkett.
Jeez, I'm so scared now of fucking up names.
No, that's right.
I'm known worldwide for my great memory.
Steven plays her.
Yeah, and then the brother, Josh Lucas's character, who's sort of the bad boy. Although, truthfully, it's very superficial because you could argue they both share this disposition. One's more aggressive. One's more passive-aggressive. Yeah. But they're both pretty fucked up. Yeah. They can only get to a certain level, and they can't go further, whether it's in their whatever, their growth as human beings, emotional growth.
Yeah.
They're stunted, and they're toxic around each other.
Yeah.
But
they both sort of handle rage in different ways.
Right.
I think one internalizes a lot more than the other. One kind of plays a game out of... Josh's character, Matt, makes a game out of pushing people away and stuff and pushing them to see how far they can go with his ill treatment.
Well, so tell me, do you have a brother?
I do. An older brother.
Yeah. Because I would imagine, one would be curious, since you wrote the story, right? You wrote the screen.
Yeah. Well, I wrote the script myself and wrote the story actually with Minna Joseph and Russell Harbaugh, who
we used to,
it was a roommate of ours, a good friend, a really talented filmmaker. And also has a brother. Mm-hmm. Minna has a brother, and Russ is a twin. Russ has a twin brother, which has its own set of psychic.
I bet it does.
Yeah,
baggage. Sure, sure.
So we had a lot. Yeah. So basically, we structured it all together, upstate in the house in the Catskills, and then I kind of. So Russ and I were kind of writing the script together for a little while, and then I kind of took it over and just ended up writing it all myself. But the initial idea about making something about brothers was for me, and I think it. Yeah, I think it. Probably is basic, essentially rooted in my own relationship with my brother and my family. But he's not, Matt's character is not exactly an analog for my brother at all. They basically both kind of swap out different characteristics that we both share and exaggerate them too. Matt is a pretty, he's pretty caustic and pretty. Harsh and pretty aggressive in his sort of explicit various hatreds. And my brother's not quite that way. My brother's a much more gentle person, I would say.
Okay.
Nicer.
Yeah. There's a scene fairly early on. And in fact, it's the opening sequence where, which is a long part. There's a nice little, first of all, I don't know if you call it quite a prologue. No, but there is the opening
functions like a prologue.
Has a nice little visual joke to it, or whatever you want to call it, twist to it.
Uh-huh.
I'm talking about the initials, like post-coital scene, right? And then, okay, but we don't need to add that. I just thought that was cute. And then, but I don't want to give it away.
Part?
Oh, no, the very, very beginning.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a joke.
But
I'm not going to put that in the podcast because it's supposed to be a joke. So you don't want to give that away. But I will say the opening sequence is this party that you guys are having, Matt and Farrah are having.
Yeah, a very, very long party
long
sequence.
Party. It's really great, yeah.
Opens the film.
Well, it's nice because it really breathes, and you can put a lot together from that whole opening sequence. And it also incorporates, ultimately, the long-lost brother coming back into their lives, all of a sudden appears on the couch. It's pretty I like the way that whole thing is choreographed, Anyway, so sure, and there a fight breaks out between Farrah and Matt, and he says something that I don't know how and then you guys go on vacation the next day, but where he says he points out that Farrah doesn't even have college education.
Farrah and Alan.
See, I'm going to be terrible with the names.
You for your...
Sorry. I'm going to have to go back and fix all that then.
Oh, right. That fight on the couch.
Alan and Farrah, because Matt's the other brother.
Yeah, Matt is Josh Lucas.
Right, okay, gotcha. Right, and he says something like out of in a moment of anger, but he says like he kind of lords it over your head that you never finished college.
Right.
Yeah, and it's like, wow, I don't know how you kind of rebound after that. Like,
how you rebound from it?
Well, it's so mean. It's yeah. so mean, and that's what I'm getting at. Like almost anything that Matt does is, you know, it's kind of for shock value on some level, but it's at least it's out there in the open, and he's kind of like, this is my thing. This is my, protective mm-hmm. thing. Whereas with Alan, you don't know, like, if he could say something that cruel, like, in front of people,
yeah.
like, kind of say something that could be a real point of vulnerability for your character, you know, just, it's a... Anyway, I guess what I'm getting at is, did you guys have conversations about your relationship and how you were going to arrive at how a relationship... Like, what you got from each other?
We talked a little bit about, like, who Fair was and and their relationship. And was it you guys or was it... I can't remember. There was some sort of conversation about the Farrah's relationship to Alan was, like, that she was, like, pushing a melting snowball up a hill.
Uh-huh.
I think maybe I said that.
That sounds, yeah.
Like, that it was just like, it was getting, you know, like when you push a snowball up a hill and yeah. it like gets bigger and bigger, but at the same time it's like, Min is laughing, she thinks it's funny. But it's like melting at the same time as you're like trying to push it up the
right.
hill.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was sort of like my direction for myself.
So like you felt like you were pushing him towards what, committing more in
towards... Well, it's just sort of like, you know, like... To where, you know, like the you see the potential, and so she sort of was like pushing him yeah. to where she thought, you know, and at the same time he's sort of like melting,
mm-hmm.
And it's just yeah, and I think maybe that push that she her like her need to like is frustrating and probably like deeply annoying to him, and so he snaps and says mean things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think it's like.
Well, I think so, and I think the snapping is, like, basically, like, the whole movie to me is about snapping. Mm-hmm. It's about basically saying, pushing people to a limit where you can't really go back and then going back, basically, and then making it okay the next morning. I mean, right. it, to me, is unfortunately, yeah. maybe, to me, that's, like, sort of, like, what defines family in a way, just sort of the ability to fix, to heal, basically, to heal...
And sometimes in an instant, too.
Hmm?
So yeah, it can happen. And you can
yeah.
you can snap in an instant, which is I guess what yeah. what it means to snap. But and say the most hurtful, horrible things to the people that you love the most, or have no choice but to love.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we had a family get together, and granted, we had a death in the family that year of a cousin.
Yeah,
lots. You know, a few things had gone by, and so the dynamic of the. You know, might have changed a bit, but and my sister and a cousin got into it, which is not untypical because in a Jewish family, at dinner, especially the holidays, you get it. You know, you fight. I mean, that's part of the tradition. So, but in this case, it was starting to escalate, and then my dad, who you know is my sister's advocate, of course. You know, gets very angry and yells at my cousin, and my cousin and my dad kind of like literally like start to puff up and like get come to blows.
Yeah.
And then I found myself like as mediator, what is it called? As trying to kind of referee and try to, you know, talk to everybody and try to get everybody. And finally, my cousin came back in, apologized, my father. You know, and then it was like we talked it out, and it was actually the best thing could have happened because I think there was a lot of tension there.
Yeah.
So I think you're you know there's like a lot of I think even though it's movie like in a lot of ways The Mend, it's also there's a lot of things that go on in terms of their relationship, the brother's relationship, I think Alan's relationship with Farrah, all these things that people really do say in those relationships.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been married.
It's well then
and
you
I'm
know.
Not married anymore. But,
yeah.
You know.
Well, it's what's funny too honest. Is that I edited that our editor Joe Krings. Is I think is he married? He's been in a long time relationship, and he's married.
His wife will kill you if you don't recognize their marriage.
He's definitely married in a very loving relationship.
Woman,
yes. And they're going to be married for forever, probably.
She
almost
she
certainly
basically donates her husband to the cause of indie films because she doesn't see him for a long time when he gets into a project.
He gets hired on for a 10-week editing gig and she does not see him.
Yes.
So he might as well be at war.
Yeah.
This may be the trick.
But so this fight between Alan and Farrah, which is one of the more vicious fights in the movie, he basically wanted to cut out all the harshest things in a way or get around them somehow or cut away from them because he just didn't. That's not how his relationship is. I mean, that's just not how we avoid conflict like this. We could never say these things to each other. And so it's not that he found it fundamentally unrealistic. He might have found it fundamentally unrelatable for him.
Yeah.
And I see harsh treatment in movies all the time, and I'm like, well, I can't imagine.
Do you think people like that, though, that don't fight or just try to avoid confrontation on that level?
Yeah.
I could see there's advantages to it, too. But I wonder if there's always sometimes when they see arguing and, you know, even like if there isn't a little bit of jealousy, like, wow, you know, you could say that and still love each other.
I think so. I mean, I guess. Yeah, I think so. I think the honesty is something you would be jealous of. I don't think brutality can be something.
No, right. Yeah, clearly you don't want toxicity.
It's right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think there's always something fun about watching a couple who can be very kind of frank with each other and you know, to me it's a little sadder to see a couple of 20 years who can't be honest with each other or be, you know, or still kind of tiptoeing around each other.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I think that's something we discussed, you know, me and Mickey and Steven, about just I think Farrah's becoming exhausted by sort of supporting him, not financially, but, like, just sort of supporting his...
Yeah.
Yeah, his attitude, basically, or supporting his, you know, sense of happiness and goodness and whatever, and just sort of, like, trying to fill in all the blanks for him.
Yeah, and there's another nice moment just so people know it's not all about anger management. It's also, there's a moment where you're late.
That's what it should be called.
three, yes.
Oh, was there anger management too and I missed it? There was?
Is that Adam Sandler?
I don't think in...
Jack Nicholson.
They were in the movie. Yeah. No.
Let's analyze this. Anger management is Adam Sandler.
We're missing all the jewels.
And Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, it's a pretty bad movie.
Clearly don't know anything.
It's clearly Jack trying to stay relevant, which he didn't have to worry about. He did
It's the exact same movie. They just have different titles.
Kind of.
Now, I believe it's about, instead of being a mobster, Jack Nicholson plays a very angry man.
Yeah.
He goes, or no, Adam Sandler? Yeah, and then
they both meet in anger management.
They both meet. Yeah, they meet in an anger management course.
Kind of.
And hilarity.
Except Nicholson.
Soon follows.
Unless Nicholson wrote a book about it, and I'm forgetting. Because, anyway, it's okay. Write in, folks, if you know the movie well. And not to be confused with the series Anger Management, which is, what's his name? Charlie Sheen series, right?
Oh, yes. Have not seen that.
Nor have I. Min, you watch them, right?
Min is a pretty big Charlie Sheen fan.
I bet.
I love Charlie Sheen.
Do you like Charlie Sheen?
Yeah. I mean...
Young Charlie? You mean now Charlie Sheen?
You should do a movie with Charlie Sheen.
You should do a movie. You're the one who's more in a position.
The movie with you and Charlie Sheen, what would it be?
Anger Management 5.
No. What was it? Like Lion Blood? What was it called?
Oh, Tiger Blood. That's what he was
doing. Tiger
named.
Blood.
That and the meth.
Tiger Blood and meth.
Yeah.
It's a lethal combo.
Yeah.
Don't act innocent. You know what we're talking about, don't you? Tiger Blood? So how did you get... Mickey, how did it come about that you got cast in The Mend? Like, and did you get sent a script or...
I met Minna first. Minna was at the director's Sundance Lab in 2010. God, I feel old. So 2010, I was there with another project, Sean Durkin's project, and Minna was there. And we met, and we became friends, and then sort of stayed in touch. And then one summer, she called me up and said, will you read our script? John's directing. And I only read the first scene in which I have a fight with Alan about him coming in my face. And I wrote an email right away and just said yes. Yeah, I didn't.
You actually said, this is something I want on my reel.
Oh, yeah, did I? Yeah.
That's a sizzle reel if I ever heard
yeah.
that.
Yeah. That's a,
did you get nervous about that scene?
Yes, she was concerned about that scene.
Who was?
My manager.
Oh.
But I had to explain that no one was actually coming in my face.
Oh, I thought you were going to say... I thought worst you were going to say nobody's actually going to come and see the movie.
I wish I had been privy to that conversation.
That would be funnier.
Because Sue is awesome, and to hear you having to explain...
No, he's going to see this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
That would have been terrible thing to do.
Yeah.
Especially if it ended...
This is really obscure. I'm just going to do it for... No one else.
For the sizzle reel.
No matter how profane it is.
Why did you...
I bet it did appeal to you. Maybe... No, not the actual thing, but I mean the character having that in the... outrageousness?
Fight, I don't know. There was something so funny and so real about that scene. Uh-huh. And I was just great. And it's so rare that you read... I'm sorry to keep having to have this conversation about women in film, but I'm just going to keep going until other people write better roles for women. But it's just so rare that you read scripts where women are real women with three dimensions and not just a prop.
Right,
and
for the guy.
Yeah, not just a function, and they're they have complexity, and that was really what drew me to Farrah in the script. This is a real woman with she's, wait, but John's fist pumping. We got to explain now.
He's gesticulating.
He's fist pumping.
Gesturing.
And then Minna pointed to herself.
As though?
These women would be flat characters if it weren't for my touch.
I did place Farrah on Minna,
You could actually hear in Mickey's American accent. On occasion, it just sounded like Minna, which actually I didn't think about too much. But then Minna's, was it your sisters who were freaked out? They saw it and they were like, "My God, Farrah seems like you, Minna."
Well, that's because of Mickey. I feel like Mickey is the on-screen version of me.
It's a good choice to have, right? You're going to cast yourself, they high-five.
And in terms of, creating fleshed-out, female characters, I think it is just... I mean, I hate to say it's a priority, because that makes it sound like you're just doing it to create fleshed-out... I don't know. You hope that every character is fleshed out, but I think I'm also just... luckily in my life, I've been surrounded by intelligent, independent-minded, strong women, and it'd be silly not to want to... represent them to show them,
because the women kind of are also put in positions of caretaker forced in this film, and it's something that it's interesting that I've expected
enablers
I've expected for it to come up more in conversation. And I mean, it's an interesting dialogue in the film where nobody is perfect, and then this film certainly doesn't side with the male characters at all. And typically, your character, Mickey's character, certainly has less screen time than most people, but sort of your presence grounding it is important for the rest of the narrative to happen. So while she's on screen, she has to be as three-dimensional and alive and palpable as any other character, or in order for the entire film to work, really.
But also, even though you're absent for, Minna just pointed out, your absence actually is important to the... is kind of an important part of the film. It drives
lot
of the plot. Yeah, it drives the story along, that you're not there. Where are you? And, you're causing Alan, of course, a lot of turmoil and panic.
Yeah.
Right? He does love Farrah. There's also in the same party scene, late at night, as some parties go.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the guests are part of the dance company you work for, as he also acidly points out. You're not a dancer. You're an administrator at the dance company or something like that. Another kind of mean-spirited thing to say, but at the moments later, I believe he's watching you, dancing and clearly in love.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think she has... She's certainly, I think, more fulfilled in that kind of realm of her life. I don't think... I mean, at one point, Alan goes to work in the movie, and, I don't think there's any real... He's not really feeling any connection to what he does in a way.
Right. Oh, that's right.
But it is true that also that, when Minna was saying about the kind of the women In the movie, I hope, being, you know, are funny and smart and kind of have their own lives. But they all are, what's crazy is that they all end up being kind of almost forced into these pretty supportive roles. You know, they're very much supporting or managing. You know, Matt, Lucy, who, Matt's girlfriend, Andrea, is, talk about anger management. I mean, it's basically she's just there. She's connected to him because she doesn't really have anywhere else to go right now.
Yeah.
He fulfills something for her. Mm-hmm. Probably part of it's physical. But he's a ticking time bomb always, and she just is kind of waiting around before he says something or does something that just pushes her away again, and it yeah. gets broken, and maybe it'll get fixed again.
It's a little Russian roulette-ish, because he's yeah. just waiting for the,
yeah.
you know, the boat in, to get into the that. There's also even Austin Pendleton, who is a supporting character in the film. His partner, or whatever, is there mm-hmm. just you know to
help oh, Beatrice. Him, oh, the one at the party or at
no,
the
no,
later?
At later.
Oh,
oh
yeah.
right, there is that too. I forgot. That's right. He's got several women in his life.
He does. Anyway, and they're all they are all actually kind maybe of purely in. Well, he's a strange.
Yeah.
He's, as a character, he's strange. It's sort of
it's a nice touch.
It's sort of hard to know if he's had sex in 30 years, or if he just always is with a woman who sort of.
Well, maybe the, you know, the hand operations yeah, are because of masturbation or excessive
oh,
masturbation.
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
so he's. We know at least he's doing that. He makes a joke about a.
Oh yes, I remember.
Oh, so before, by the way, Mickey, you mentioned your manager, and this is something I'm very curious about, and I like to know when I bring on actors because, well, I think it's interesting. Like the manager is obviously trying to gear you towards more, I don't know, certain types of projects. Let's put it that way, right? And so when they get something that's offbeat or very distinctive like this, that doesn't, there's not a ton of the men's. With proven track records before the men, in other words.
Sure, of course. Yeah.
You're not trying, you know, this is a very organic thing.
Yeah. It's not the tough thing about independent films is that a lot of times they're
right.
not,
right.
you read them and they're not really templates for
faith,
anything. They're not based on anything directly, so it's hard to know
yeah.
what they're getting, it's not hard to know, honestly, what they're getting into, what their actors are getting into.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering, like, obviously she expressed a little concern about that opening scene that we talked about with the, you know, we don't have to repeat it again. And then you're also missing, as we also pointed out, for a chunk of the film. So what was your manager's... Did they bring that up too?
Like, I have a very... uh-huh. I'm really lucky. Like, I have a really great relationship with my manager where, you know, for both of us, like, my career is really, like, we're trying to create something that is long-lasting.
Sustainable.
And sustainable and sort of built on work that I can be proud of, and that that pushes me as an actress, and
showcases your
yeah,
diverse,
and
you know,
like I
roles.
Am not, you know, like I'm not like a network TV face, you know. I'm there is something like I know that I don't fit into like the sort of like the no, I fit into the men. Like, I, you know, like, that I fit
well,
into, no, it's
well,
like, I'm so,
up.
Like, I want
to
be in more men's, because, like,
it's
that's,
nice hear, right?
no, it's
yeah.
like a world where, like, I feel like I can be seen, and,
yes.
Are you interested in being a character actor, ultimately?
I think I am a character actress.
That's
I mean,
answer. Yeah. I mean, are you, you know, I mean, like, you're supposed to be,
yeah.
historically, I mean, I think things are changing. You know, I have a kid whose mom is an actress, and she's beautiful. But you know, from the start, wanted to get character roles because she wanted to act, she wanted to be on Broadway, she wanted to work.
I mean, I don't really know what character actress.
Well,
it just means
not
leading. No,
well,
no, I want
to
be leading.
No.
Wait.
I don't even think I mean that.
I want to be leading.
No, but you know what? Men doesn't matter what they like. We talked about Jack Nicholson. I mean, you know, those movies that he made. Before you were probably born, though, like Five Easy Pieces.
Yeah.
This is not a Hollywood-looking guy. I mean, he was good-looking, handsome-ish,
yeah.
but not in any Hollywood way. But he was... I don't even know if that makes sense. Let's just say he's not... Because there are a lot of... Humphrey Bogart yeah. wasn't either, but a lot of people weren't. There's more leeway with men, I think,
yeah.
with that, too. Women were always gorgeous.
Yeah.
So you could be the lead. It's just it's not based on just looks, just... You know, yeah. a role with...
You don't turn down roles because they're small.
No,
Chapter,
I mean...
Right?
I mean jump in.
I just feel like there are certain performers that don't immediately come to mind when people are casting sort of more direct genre work, and I think Mickey is in the camp of kind of being an enigmatic performer, and that's the strength and also the challenge with somebody like that.
She thought the word enigmatic was a compliment, and it is, but it's nice
that
you think.
I mean, I really, like, right? I love being able to, like, hide behind a role.
Yeah.
I love, like, if someone, when people say, like, when Noah Baumbach told me I had to dye my hair and wear glasses to play Sophie, like, I was,
in Frances
like,
Ha.
Thrilled.
Yeah.
I find it really exciting to be a chameleon and to, like...
Yes. Well, that's what I'm talking about. That's what I was talking about. Oh, I love this.
What are you going to say, John?
It was just funny. I remember at New York Film Festival, when he introduced you and Greta, he basically apologized for dyeing your hair and putting you in glasses. Which I was like, I don't, you know, it's funny. What's funny is there was someone on Twitter recently who really liked saw the mend, and I think found out via Twitter that Mickey was also the co-lead in Frances Ha, and was just shocked. Yeah, which I think is awesome. Oh,
and
yeah,
we just saw some pretty fantastic stills from a film you're in where she's like straight out a working girl, and you know you wouldn't even know it was Mickey.
A 1980s feathered. She looked. I mean. Yeah. You're chameleonic.
Thank you.
That is what I'm talking about. And here's a great example of what I'm getting at.
I feel like this is like a pep talk for me right now.
Right. It's motivational. No, but we also talked about Meryl Streep earlier, and there's a great example. Meryl Streep also, I looked at her as a accidental leading lady. Like, she's a character actor who just happened to be so brilliant that she became a leading lady, but she's not. And the reason why her career has been so long is because she's a character actor, not because she's a leading lady. Nobody, what other leading lady has had a 40-year career?
No,
there's none. They disappear in this business, that business. I'm not in that. You know,
Blanchett, I think. Kate Blanchett.
Yeah, but she's, she's been around maybe 20 years. Yeah. But you're right.
Is that they're actresses who don't fit a certain mold, and they're... dynamism is the thing that
it's
will
kind of
keep them going.
One of the few areas in Hollywood that feels still, well, this might sound stupid, but it's still kind of meritocratic. Or it's like, it's nice that Cate Blanchett and Meryl Streep are so successful, because they're some of the most talented actors in the world. I mean, it's kind of impressive when that actually happens.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe not, it's not.
I mean, they're still not being paid the same amount as male actors.
Isn't isn't she also driving some sort of organization right now where she's...
She is founding a women's writers laboratory grant.
Over 40,
women. That's what it is, right? Women over 40, right.
Yeah. Which is...
But what it comes down to is, the
box. Money and access. Yeah. Money and access.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how Minna feels, but I mean, I definitely think the independent film world is a little bit more. I don't know. It's not as bad. Not quite as bad as Hollywood in terms of.
It's funny that we're talking about this related to The Mend, because it's such a male-driven film.
Yeah, that's true.
But
it's a masculine movie.
Yeah,
it's a masculine movie.
One conversation we had that was more along the lines of what I expected at a festival in France in Belfort. Where we had a long discussion with a very engaged audience member, where it kind of came to identify that one of the discomforts of The Mend is that you're kind of watching how things are and not how you might want them to be in terms of gender. And I think that's an incredibly sort of painful and raw line that it walks for a lot of people. So it's like you watch it and you're not necessarily wanting to see that reality reflected.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's also a lot of
it.
People who just are almost it's a lot of characters who are essentially addicted to bad behavior, can't help themselves in some ways. What was funny about the screening, another thing that was funny about the screening in France is that I can't remember her name. She was really awesome. She found the movie like remarkably retrograde in its attitude towards marriage, because basically marriage ends up being such a big deal in the movie. And I guess in France, they just don't consider marriage proposals and stuff events or things that are planned or things that are, you know, can sort of like crush someone or make someone stay or whatever. And so that was really interesting. I felt extremely regressive talking to her in front of other people about my backwards movie involving marriage proposals.
Yeah, it was really funny. Actually, the programmers were making jokes about it too, of like, oh, you Americans and your marriage proposals, you come over to Paris and you make these really important proposals that are just like ridiculous.
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
you know,
that's true.
I mean, it was almost, yeah. Was,
if we didn't, you know, who would? Who would in Paris?
You spent all that money on the flight, the trip, the hotels.
Absolutely.
You could, emails are free. Just
through
marriage? Question mark. It's over. So, you know, you could tweet it. The Man, which is starring again Josh Lucas and Steve Plunkett, Mickey Sumner, Lucy Owen. Owen, of course, I know who it is. Lucy Owen, co-starring Austin Pendleton, Leo Fitzpatrick, Sarah Steele.
Sarah Steele.
And the young guy again.
Corey Nichols.
Corey Nichols, adorable young guy. He's probably now in his well into puberty. And
we're waiting. We're holding. We're waiting.
Go see this film. It's directed by John McGarry and produced by Minna Joseph and Michael Prahl. See, I can do it. I can do it. I think I can. Anything else? Where's the...
It's playing at the IFC Center,
IFC
August
Center?
21st.
Oh, that's a good spot.
And then the Sundance Cinema is on Sunset in L.A. And then in a smattering of cities after that.
Right.
Chicago, Seattle, mm-hmm. Albuquerque. Maybe.
Of course,
hello.
Albuquerque.
Philadelphia,
yeah. Uh-huh. They just
Austin, Knoxville, Tennessee.
Great cities, all been to all those places.
Yes.
And is there a website? You go to Facebook.
Oh yes,
the Man's on Facebook.
Cinelicious is the distributor. And
oh yes, our friends is. Mm-hmm. We like Cinelicious.
Which I think is CineliciousPix.com or yes, CineliciousPix.com. PICS, and everyone knows how to spell Cinelicious, so I'm not going to even spell it.
Cinema with Twitter handle.
And the Twitter handle is The Mend Film.
Very good.
Yes. And my name is John McGarry, and I also have a Twitter handle that I check more regularly than The Mend's.
Well, thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
It was great to meet everybody to hang out. As I mentioned, Joe Swanberg's been on the show many times, and this is yet his 34th occasion to visit the show. He's welcome on many, many more times to come, of course, because I like this guy. He's warm, he's witty. This is one of my favorite segments I've ever done. Jake Johnson, great actor, countless films. He's in Jurassic World, which is the biggest selling film of all time, they say. Biggest box office. I don't know. I haven't seen it, but I'm going to because I like Jake Johnson, and he couldn't have been nicer. So let's do this. Now, this film is it's open already theatrically, and it's going to be coming on demand in a couple of days. So let's get right into that conversation.
I'm just waiting to get my life back. When did it come back?
You're married?
Mm-hmm.
Since when?
It's a license plate.
Wow.
Yeah, there's garbage in
the
ground.
Stop,
if you dig far enough, you'll find a landfill.
Wow. Right now, and I don't even know you.
That's very liberating.
Being in love, what is that? Getting what you want, or is it giving somebody what they want?
Do you not yourself right now?
I found something!
Oh! I feel like you're.
What do you think is going on here? Shady
baby, I'm hot. Well, if you don't want to dig, how about some hookers?
No, that's a sort of an illogical jump you just made. Bigger Bartolini, meanie, money, moe, and flower.
Enjoy them. We're not all eating them. They're literally going to get thrown out.
No, they're not.
Yes, that's right.
No, they're not. I can tell you right now.
They're not. I have several children at home. And I think... Okay,
really,
I'm going to make a mess
here.
The
bio here says there are no children at home.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I have. So not buzzed or buzzed? Or?
No, not buzzed.
Okay.
Not buzzed at all.
No. Okay, I'm just doing this
I
for my own.
Four sips of beer.
Yeah,
Basically, that's what it was, right? It was like a tasty.
So I'm sitting with filmmaker Joe Swanberg, an actor, and Jake Johnson, actor. The film is called Digging for Fire, coming out Friday. That's the
21st in theaters and 25th on VOD.
Well done.
Thanks.
Well done. The film reunites, actually, Joe and Jake were last together for, I believe, X-Men Days of Future Past was the film?
No.
Was that it?
Mm-mm.
No. Oh, no, it was the one with the beer.
That's correct.
Okay. That was a good one.
No, we did an X-Men together, but not Days of Future Past.
Oh, okay. Alrighty.
I was in X-Men 2.
I know.
Was its name? The Quickening. Something like that.
Age of Ultron. I know. You haven't been in any. We've been in some big films. You're going to be doing Jurassic World, Jake?
I'm not going to be doing it. You did it, rather.
I'm sorry.
When are you shooting Jurassic World, Jake?
The next Jurassic World.
Have you not seen anything about the news, my man?
Deserved. Sorry. I'm discombobulated. I'm on sleep deprivation, or I'm dealing with sleep deprivation, so I apologize. No, I know Jurassic World came out a couple months ago.
Yeah.
You know, my childhood.
Highest grossing movie of all time.
Is it all time?
It was something crazy like that.
Number three of all time.
Why are you talking to either one of us? I don't understand. Jake. The film stars Jude Swanberg and some other people.
He just insisted on having first billing, and none of us wanted to fight with him about it.
Yeah. But the thing is this time I said, now I saw a little, right? You saw a little Joe Swanberg. He looks just like his father.
He looked just like me from the moment he was born. When he came out of my wife's vagina, I looked at his face.
So she did not have a C-section. We've established that.
I thought, man, that baby looks just like me. It's like a Photoshop joke where somebody took my face and put it on a baby. And he just continues to look just like me the older he gets. Though I know Chris's face well enough that I see a lot of her in it, but also occasionally I'll look at him and think, he looks just like pictures of me when I was that age.
Right. The lucky part of the whole thing is that he's a boy, because if could have been a girl who looked just like you.
Well, I just had a girl who also looks just like me.
Wait, you just had your second child?
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thanks. And
what's her name?
Her name is Abigail.
Okay.
And I am very curious to see if she looks just like me when she is 13 years old, and I hope the answer is no.
Is Chris getting annoyed? Or she just sees herself in that? I'm sorry, Jake. We'll get. You have children. So.
We have one.
You didn't know this was
easier to do this with one mic to just talk to one person.
I'm sorry, we're going to get to you. I just was surprised.
I would rather do this than the back and forth.
Can I remind you, you said, don't rush this one. Let him talk. We're going to go over.
At that point, I thought you had three mics. My good man.
I thought I would start 20. You can have this mic. Actually, you should interrupt all you want. That's right, because you're being respectful of what I asked, which was not to. Sure. I'm sorry. Because you have actually germane things to say.
It's called table talk, I believe. Keep the table talk to a minimum.
Sorry. So you were saying Chris.
Chris just accepts the reality that these babies look hardcore like Swanbergs.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, congratulations. I had no idea. It's nice to hear.
Breaking news.
And it's nice that your son has now a little sister. It's nice to have
I hope
two,
it's nice.
A pair.
Yes.
One of each.
That's another thing that I'll check back with you in 5 years and tell you if it's nice or not.
And I hope she looks.
I hope she looks
the
like
looks
Chris.
Work for her too, because I'm sure they. I'm sure. Come on, you have a very lovely wife, right? Okay, let's get to the film at hand. I'm sorry, I apologize, because I keep getting distracted. And then I'm saying, I know Chris just had a film come out too.
She did. Unexpected.
Got good reviews.
It's a great movie. I love it.
So a little plug for Chris.
I would talk about Chris for the entire duration of this thing.
But I would want to do that. So Jake, I'm happy to
thank you for. We need you too, homeboy.
This one's plugged in.
Yeah, if we don't have you, it gets super weird. Then I'm not sure what we're. Right now, I barely know what. Yes. Right now, I'm not positive. Without
no, I've
you
done
talking,
it with three,
then it's just you and me hanging out.
Well, I've done it three, and by the end of it, the whole thing. I'm like a rapper.
You mic dropped yourself, which I respect.
Is it warm in here?
It's really hot,
Jesus
actually.
Jesus Christ.
I'm burning up.
I'm getting flush.
And I wonder if they turned the AC off because of that last one.
Oh,
because I'm having the same moment you're having, where I feel like I'm going through menopause.
I don't want to use the term.
I'm like, everybody's talking to her in this motherfucking podcast. I'm burning up. So the movie Digging for Fire.
Digging for Fire.
We shot this one in 15 days. It is loosely based off a true story where I was in my backyard digging with my wife. We were trying to put a garden back there, and I found a gun, a bone, a license plate, a bag of marbles, and I called the Los Angeles Police Department.
Can I borrow the microphone just to say how much I enjoy the fact that you always mention the bag of marbles? But also, I don't know how to picture them. So will you please elaborate on what
I was sure you were going to say something about losing yours.
Yeah. So the reason that I always mention the bag of marbles is because it is based in truth, and I don't want to just sell
how many marbles.
There was – it was really scary, actually. So the part – so it was about 25 to 30 marbles in like
a – like the thick shooter kind or the little normal guys?
Like a dime size one.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and – so the part of the story that I'll say in this podcast that I haven't been doing in press, for example, on the Today Show, is how – and I don't know if I've talked to you about this – how stoned I was throughout the entire process. So when we were doing it, it was right before I was doing the Paper Heart press tour.
Yeah.
And I had 12 days before I had to do a tour, and I was so nervous. I've never done anything like it. And I just started getting into Woody Guthrie.
Uh-huh.
And I just started like buying really good California weed. So I was smoking so much grass. So everything I found was the most terrifying and exciting thing.
Right.
So the bone was like...
There's just intense paranoia through the whole process.
And so in, it's funny that you mentioned the marbles because I haven't known why I need to bring it up. But there was this, it was, that was a horror movie.
It hit you. It registered.
Was, yes. Like it was, you, I saw
the marbles are a big piece of that experience.
For me, the gun, I was like... To Aaron, I'm like, honey, I know that this could be a cap gun. I'm not an idiot.
Yeah.
While I had a joint in my mouth with no shirt on, plastic when he got there. And I was like, the license plate, and then I had a bag, and as I pulled it up, when I saw marbles, I could have started crying in fear. I was like, what kind of animal?
Yeah.
And she's like, well, it could be just a kid's marbles. Yeah. And I'm like, thank you for saying that, because I was in an utter panic.
Yeah.
But so I found all that stuff, and I called the LAPD, and I told them what I'd found. I said, I found this stuff in my yard, and they said what they say in the movie. We took that scene directly, which was a few discussions if we were going to do it, and then we decided to, and the woman on the other line said, it sounds like a bunch of garbage, and I go, or a dead person buried in my yard, but that's why I'm calling you. She goes, what would you like me to do about it? And I said, well, you're the police. She said, it's not our job to dig out somebody else's garbage. So if you find a dead body, then call us and we'll come. Years later, Joe and I are talking. We did the movie Drinking Buddies, and we loved working together, and we wanted to make a movie that was somewhat of a follow-up to it, but not a Drinking Buddies Part 2. For no other reason besides we wanted to do something different. And so I pitched him this loose idea about the dead body. He got excited. We started talking. And then started talking about, you can't just, we didn't want to make a movie just about digging on the side of a hill. So we started talking about a relationship and what it meant. And then a few months later, we came up with an outline for Digging for Fire.
How many times did you watch Stand By Me as a kid?
Over 500.
Same here. I mean, that was a movie
that
my brothers and I just
love it.
Could end, and we could just rewind it and start the movie right back from the beginning.
And the final scene where he hears the voiceover and he's writing, to this day I get emotional. And the arc of a group of people saying, what do you want to do? Do you want to see a dead body? And you drop everything to do that, because what else is there? Is, for me, going back to our conversations about story and filmmaking, that story.
Yeah.
That you frame it with, I'm a writer now.
Yeah.
I'm not the guy I was. Will I ever have friends like this?
Yeah.
But what's the story about? You're building towards seeing the body, and you see it, and then something happens.
Yeah.
And so that aspect, we talked about Stand By Me a lot for Digging for Fire. But then we really, and I credit it to, while you weren't here before, you brought the Swamberg isms to it, and that is a really intense adult relationship and the ins and outs of marriage.
Well, when you started talking to me about the story, it just immediately started to register for me in those terms. Like, it was so natural that stuff came to it. Because I, thinking about this guy, I mean, I know you were telling me a story about you, but thinking about a man in his backyard with his grown friends on a sort of Stand By Me mission immediately makes me think of a guy who is, yearning for a sense of childhood that got lost somewhere along the way. He's like, I still need an adventure. Like, I haven't reached my quota of adventure yet. Nope. And there's something going on here. And I'm like, who is that guy? Who is his wife? Like, what, where is this desire coming from to still do this, to like get the boys together and to like have this night?
And it's sort of the, you know, it's also, you know, they're in this kind of like big playhouse.
Yeah.
It's like a big playhouse that they've got the keys for
yeah,
you know, the weekend or whatever amount of time. And
well, that's Hollywood, man.
Yeah.
This big, nice play area,
but
where you don't live and the rules are different. And
but so that's an interesting thing where you said that's Hollywood. So I get asked a lot about this movie, about why are all so many faces and so why so many celebrities? And what's funny about it is that's not Hollywood, but that is Hollywood to somebody from Chicago.
Yes.
Who comes in and visits.
Yes.
And while they're visiting, they go to like some weird party where they're like, who's here? Wait, that actor and that actor. And so the thing that I realized in talking about it in press was this is Joe Swanberg's Hollywood movie.
Absolutely. It's an outsider's picture, and I always felt that your character naturally represented that for me. It's why I was so excited about you wearing the Chicago Bulls stuff and everything else, because it is Joe Swanberg's Hollywood. It's absolutely my experience of going to Los Angeles for work and playing in this other area and then going home.
On some level, I'm going to say, because you surround yourself with this, it's an ensemble film, as you said, Jake, and you were surrounding yourself with very, very your intimates in a way. I mean, somebody was recently on this podcast, Kent Osborne, even you had, it's nice to see. It's like you're shrouding yourself on some level too. Like, so you take whatever you had in Chicago and you're bringing it to your new home.
Yeah.
Your recently new home, you know. It also reminded me on some level, because of that ensemble, really, in the best of ways, of like Altman at his best.
Definitely. I mean, I think that the instincts are probably the same, which is that you have a group of friends and you have these amazing actors. And
they're improvising is your style.
Well, it's interesting because I mean, I have complicated feelings about the movie being packed wall to wall with famous people. One of those feelings is I acknowledge the point of view that's distracting, right? That every time somebody who's that famous shows up, there's a piece of you that is solely focused on the real person and the sort of fame level that they bring to it, right?
Yeah, for sure.
But then there's this other feeling that I have, which is those people are famous because they're really good at their jobs. They're very talented actors.
Right.
Why wouldn't you want to work with all of the most talented actor, even if it's somebody who's only in the movie for 45 seconds? Why wouldn't you want those 45 seconds to be
Jenny Slate,
Sam Elliott or Sam Jenny Slate?
Right.
Or, you know, any of these people.
And you're grappling with – go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish your thought.
Oh, no. And I think that Altman – you know, Jake and I didn't say, like, let's make a movie full of famous people. Jake and I said, let's tell this story. And then with each role that came up, it was like, man, who would be great? This person would be great. And then if we called them and they said yes, how are we not going to put them in the movie?
Right.
And so it was really an interesting organic experience of this cast growing and growing and growing over the couple weeks of pre-production, where we were just calling people based on our conversations about – in a dream world, who would play this role? Well, I mean, Sam Elliott, right? Well, when Sam Elliott gets on the phone and says, sure, I'll do it, you're like, great, man. Come on. Come join the gang. Come have fun. Anyway, I think Altman was in a similar position.
Yeah,
where it's essentially when Altman made a movie, that was an event. And everybody wanted to be a part of it. And so those casts just got crazy because he's throwing a fun party.
Yeah. Just so everybody knows, Jake, you play Tim. And you are married to the lovely Rosemary DeWitt, who plays
Lee.
Yeah, your recent parents, right? And both at that typical juncture where you're feeling confined and need to bust out a little bit, and then you're like in this playland, as we say. But Rosemary's character ends up splitting and going with the kid to not splitting
no,
in
it's
a negative way.
Apart.
It's just a weekend apart.
Yeah.
You're watching the house, supposed to do the taxes.
Yes, sir.
And yeah, she goes to her parents, correct?
Yes.
Not too far off in L.A. and then decides she's going to leave the little boy's character with the grandparents.
I feel like and an executive gonna, and hearing a pitch to a movie, and I'm like, all right, yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, well, that's correct.
Except there are people listening for a season.
I appreciate what you're doing.
My parents that listen to the show are going to want to know what we're talking about, okay? So, Mom, that was Jake.
Mom, Dad, he's doing an excellent job.
My parents. Anyway, so that's the backstory, and then back at the house, all the friends show up for a party, and meanwhile, Jake, Tim's very swept away, as we already said, with having found these remains.
That's right, which Lee has told Tim before she went.
And it's creepy.
Yeah, it's creepy, and also we don't own this house. The house belongs to one of her clients, right. So she's like, we are visitors here. So,
and you're digging up the yard.
And you're digging it. So have fun on this weekend.
Yeah.
Hang out with some friends. Drink beer. Eat pizza. I'm not your warden.
Right.
But don't go digging up in somebody else's backyard.
And don't invite Sam Rockwell. What's wrong with you?
And don't let Christmas Eve take his underpants off.
There's a couple of really kind of creepy things, though. One thing is it almost feels like it becomes – it's almost going to become a thriller – or mm-hmm. some sort of maybe not thriller in what we now call thriller, but suspense film.
Yes,
with because you're digging stuff up and it's getting darker and darker.
Absolutely.
And like, where is this going? And then the neighbor comes over, played by the great
Tom Bowen.
Tom Bowen, who's fantastic in everything he does.
edit.
Heads up for me, my editor. Edit. Oh, that's me.
He's so good in the movie.
He's really good. And he's almost menacing, even though I think he's trying to say something good. I wasn't sure.
It's one of those moments where I think Joe and I see things. We like to see things as director and writer and actor.
Yeah.
As we can have different opinions on one moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because I saw that 100% as menacing.
Okay, good.
As him saying, this isn't a theory that there are bodies under there. Right. There are bodies under there, and I'm telling you to stop looking for them.
Right.
Or I'm going to come looking for things you care about, because I care that people don't know what's on that hill.
Good.
And so
I interpreted it. Yeah.
And that, but some people have seen it more of like, he was saying like, hey man, be careful. Don't go looking for something there, or they could come looking for you.
Did you write that scene, Joe? I mean, because that was real really subtle and sophisticated stuff going on in there. And not that you're not capable of that. You are.
In terms of how it works, I mean, Jake and I met up with Tom at a cafe, talked to him about the character, how we saw the scene going.
Improvised.
Knew it was going to be one scene. And he went away and came back with a ton of material. I mean, he... in the 2 weeks between when we sat down with him and when we shot that scene, created an entire backstory, got to set, talked to Jake and I, said, this is what I think. Mm-hmm. Here's what I've been working on. I think it was this guy. I think he's lived in this neighborhood for this amount of time. I think that's typical of you know, the actors that we work with who care. They're not showing up to phone in, you know, 5 hours of a performance. They're excited to come and play. And right. So... all that richness is added to by every single person doing their homework and wanting.
But that scene, I think it's cool you brought it up, is a very important one for me in our discussions, because that's right in the middle of that second act. So that is right when the movie's kind of going, you know the journey, and now it could be a guy just keeps looking on this emotional, spiritual journey of finding something,
mm-hmm.
and Lee's character is on a journey to also look for what she's looking for. And we wanted that turn in there to say, yes, this could be symbolic,
mm-hmm.
or there could be dead bodies. It could be the Chicano Hall of Fame, for what he said, mm-hmm. in there. And the second that Tim finds this, he could be bringing a world of hurt to he and his family.
Right.
And I think the importance of that is in these stoner-ish, hipstery, you know, movies, sometimes there aren't a lot of stakes besides emotional stakes. Sometimes the stakes can be in there, you know, it's not movies I'm insulting, it's movies I'm in and that I, you know, help create. But there could be that times the stakes are like you love your partner moments less, or you feel a little less than you could, or you don't strive enough. And I personally really like when all of a sudden you've got those like movies that I grew up with stakes where you all of a sudden have all those feelings and all those, but then you could have, mm-hmm. oh, homeboy, you might just be a goofy stoner partying with your friends eating pizza like a true goober, but this could end really bad. And so for me, that scene, I love watching that one play. I like when people look around in the audience like, yeah. Why is that here?
Yeah, yeah. Joe, do you prefer the term stonerish, hipstery to mumblecore?
It kind of, I've made my peace with mumblecore. I mean,
I'm kidding.
Mumblecore, all on its own, became a thing that's not going anywhere. Yeah. That's what's interesting about it. Like, you know, in 2005, I think all of us were laughing and thinking it was funny. And yeah. Now in 2015, mumblecore is being taught in universities. It is written about in books. Like, it
jokes
is,
on you, critic or whomever. Yeah,
yeah, it's a thing.
Liquid. No,
it certainly went through a wave.
There was a backlash.
Where it was an insult.
Yeah,
and then it emerged from that wave, and yeah. Now it is just an academic.
The amount of talent that came out of that movement, because I now hear about it, so they'll be like, "They safety not guaranteed is called considered mumblecore." Yeah. Drink it. Then I'm like,
"Yeah,
like what are you like?" Yeah, they're like, "Oh, mumble." I'm like. Do you see the all-star directors that created a movement? Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah, it was a lot. I mean, that's the thing that's coolest about it is that everybody is still working.
Yeah.
Like nobody bombed out and disappeared from that scene. That is a group of filmmakers who are going to be making movies for the rest of our lives.
I think it's also a group of filmmakers that I find really cool. That took the independent movie world of kind of for our generation and said, these cool people from the 90s started making indies and said, you don't have to do the studio world. And we're saying, you could actually make these movies for 15 to 20 people.
Yeah, you don't even have to do the indie world.
You can do the indie world that at first, yes, they are extremely experimental. But you could say, which is something you and I are quite literally doing, where we can say, well, what if we put our own money into the movie? What if we actually pay for it? What if we cast our friends? Who then do we need to deal with? And it goes further into this world of 2015 with Twitter and Instagram and social media, where all of a sudden you get to the world, if you have enough people who care about what you do, well, why do you need anything besides a group of talented people who make stuff and a direct link to the people who want to see it? And why can't that be it?
Yeah.
And that, to me, was the start of Mumblecore, where I'm like, guys, for everybody doing cool creative stuff, let's turn that vibe on Mumblecore and start applauding these people, personally.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was its lasting impact. And I do think also that one of the interesting things about it is that almost every one of the Mumblecore directors is also an actor, which brought a kind of performance style into the mainstream, you know, with Mark Duplass and Greta and some of the people who were working on the earlier movies starting to do TV shows and sort of be more in people's living rooms.
Yeah.
Their performance style is a kind of hyper naturalistic style that we were not seeing. And that's why we started making those movies.
Yeah. You can't actually turn on the TV without getting Duplass in your living room now.
Yeah.
Not a bad thing. It's really incredible what's going on. Yeah. I want to mention, cause you were talking about the two of you producing the film,
but those Mumblecore movies suck. I mean, let's be honest. Yeah,
I don't even know which films you're referring to, but the third.
My sad reality is neither do I actually. I just know that
something about people. Hannah. Something about Hannah and her sisters.
Yeah.
Alicia Van Kuring is the third producer. She's been on the show too. Did you see Welcome to Me?
I did.
It's kind of a really interesting, little quirky. I don't know. That
yeah.
Another kind of strange.
Yeah,
that
I think Kristen Wiig's career is one of the coolest that's going on right now. She is doing nothing but interesting, great stuff.
Yeah, it was a really quirky film, and I really felt good after I saw it.
Like, you know what I love most about her? They were like, "So Bridesmaids 2," and she was like, "Uh-uh."
I cut the shots.
How fucking awesome is that?
That was like an easy.
I mean, come on, man.
That's another house.
That is. I know. I mean, that is just so cool and so rare. And what's crazy is that used to be standard operating procedure. Actors who made a hit movie were like, yeah, cool, we did it. And then if they made a part two, it was the, like, sub-characters from the first one. And then the studio was just like, oh, we can milk some more money out of this. So let's take the neighbor and make him the lead of part two. Because the real actor was like, yeah, I'm off doing new projects now.
Yeah.
And these days, it's just like, okay, cool. The first one worked. Great. I can do seven more. And Kristen Wiig was like, no, I made that movie.
Right.
Why wouldn't I go do new movies that I haven't made yet?
This is
the
guy
that awesome.
I agree. This is the guy who directed the first 9 minutes of Uncle Ken 2, Sell Out.
Yeah, it's
true. It's funny because you do.
And I was able to say in the first 9 minutes of Uncle Ken 2, I hate sequels, man. This is what's wrong with the movies.
It's funny. It's a good. We'll plug that too, because that's got to be coming out eventually. I assume. Maybe I don't know how it's coming out. So, but what was I going to ask say as we wind down? We'll just remind everybody: Digging for Fire out Friday, the 21st of August in New York, and on demand was
the 25th.
25th, excuse me. Good. And it stars
iTunes, Hulu, Vudu, Amazon. You got your Comcast, your Time Warner cable.
Is that your James Franco? Remember?
No, I think there's some clip that I heard about from some Atlanta senator who was writing a law that was going to not allow craft beers to be sold in certain quantities. And his attitude was, what's wrong with the beers we got?
Miller Lite.
Budweiser. Heineken.
Miller
and then
Lite.
You just hear guys in the background shouting out, Coors.
Yeah, right. That sounds funny. By the way, send out good vibes. Tomorrow, I'm directed to call the Standard Hotel in the East Village at 10 o'clock, Roger Corman's room. I'm supposed to call. Mr. Corman will...
Roger Corman's in New York right now? Can we get a meeting with Roger Corman?
Talk to Lindsay.
He's a major hero of mine.
I can't tell you. I'm so nervous about it working out. I've been pursuing
this.
This
might be
He's
the only chance I have to meet him. I might have to go stalk Roger Corman.
Listen, this could actually also... You should come with me. You'd be on the podcast, too. But I'm getting... He's going to tell me when and if. When and if. This is...
All right. Well, listen. If Roger Corman gives you the thumbs up, and I'm allowed to tag along for that... I will take
He's
you
doing
up on
two
that.
Appearances also, so you know, at the Film Anthology Archives this weekend. Maybe Friday or Saturday.
I'll
or
be
Saturday
gone
Sunday.
Already. Oh, I got right tomorrow's my day.
Okay. Let me see what happens. And I promise you, I will. I have your email.
Morning. Yeah,
so
man.
I'll just email you. Thank you, guys.
Even if I can just shake his hand.
I know. I don't care. To even just go there and just change his mind. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for listening. Have you been to iTunes and left me my comment yet? Oh, come on. If you're listening, you, I'm talking to you. You know you. Don't just say, look over your shoulder. You know what I mean. Go onto iTunes. You're subscribed? Fine. Go back onto iTunes. But did you leave a comment? I doubt it. Do you leave a star rating? I doubt it. Please, take a second. Just a few seconds. If I can get that into the hundreds, we'll have lots of, we'll be up there. You know, people will discover the show. Okay, so do that. And let's rally. Let's rally behind the show. Let's get my podcast up the ladder. It's about time. Been doing this for a number of years now. Hundreds of shows, free. Free of charge, no cost. I know you're listening. I know you like the show. I have on lots of great guests. I mentioned I may even have Roger Corman on in a couple of weeks. Come on. Coming right up in the next episodes of the film, the podcast, let me tell you what's coming up here. I meant to include on this podcast the author, Duane Epstein, because he wrote this book about Lee Marvin, which I really liked, and I invited him on the show to talk about this unsung actor, I think. We'll have it on in the next week or so. Not the actor, he's dead, but we'll have on the author. I'm going to post that. I'm going to post a conversation with Oren Moverman, who directed a film with Richard Gere, Keir Sedgwick, and Ben Vereen. It's called Time Out of Mind. Also coming up is a conversation with a fellow podcaster, Jeff Goldsmith. That'll be coming up in just a few weeks. Yeah. That's right. I know he's got a huge following, this guy. I'm trying.
trying to get people by proxy to listen to my show. I figure his listeners will listen to my show if I have him on. That's what I have to resort to. Can't just rely on you. You've betrayed me. You haven't brought on all the your friends and family and neighbors. Come on. All right, I'm not really upset. I was acting. I don't mean that. Okay. I got to get some rest. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, it's almost 2 in the morning. I need my sleep. We'll put the show up on Saturday morning. Then we'll go to see Roger Corman. We'll podcast that. It's endless. Proof positive. Exhaustion. Episode number 310 done. My name, Adam Shartoff. The podcast, Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Good night, everybody.